Chapter 3, Insiders, Guests, and Crashers. It was 1984, and journalist Bernard Kalb had been on the State Department beat for 8 years. As a veteran of the New York Times, CBS News, and NBC News, Kalb knew the frustrations of trying to squeeze information out of tight-lipped government officials, like State Department spokesman John Hughes, whom Kalb faced almost daily. In his 38 years of reporting, Kalb had dealt with countless government spokespeople, and so when Hughes decided to leave the department and move back home to Cape Cod, Kalb at first anticipated just another routine change of faces. But the change was to be unlike any in Kalb's experience. On November 28, 1984, Secretary of State George Shultz announced that he had recruited someone to replace Hughes as his Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. State's new mouthpiece would be, that's right, Bernard Kalb. And so for the next 2 years, Kalb's former colleagues struggled to squeeze information out of him, with no greater success, of course, even though they addressed him at press conferences as Bernie. How did the Reagan administration know that Kalb, seemingly a longtime adversary as a journalist, could be trusted to speak for its side and routinely tell journalists less than he knew? The answer, put simply, is that Kalb was a professional. At one level, journalism and public relations are conflicting professions. Yet the hack and the flack have the same essential qualifying attribute. The administration expects its spokespeople to answer questions at contentious press conferences without making even the slightest ideological slip. Kalb, with his decades of experience maintaining the very strict ideological discipline that is required of New York Times and network television news reporters, had the essential skill for the new job. The administration knew that his transition would be an easy one, and that they could train him to be a public relations professional in a matter of days. To train a non-professional for such a job would take years. Politically, professionals are interchangeable parts. Ideological discipline is the master key to the professions. Whatever the field, the willingness and ability to maintain correct priorities makes the professional. And no matter what the field, the professional's attitude and values are such that maintaining discipline to an assigned ideology is unproblematic. As a result, in terms of attitudes and values, professionals in very different fields have more in common with one another than with non-professionals in their own fields. The way they relate to the non-professionals they work with generally supports this view and shows the attitudes and values in question to be far from democratic. To the extent that professionals share a common outlook, employers treat them like insiders in society, as if each professional has mastered a crucial part of every profession. Thus, it is often easier for a professional to move into an entirely new field than for a non-professional to become a professional in that field, even if the non-professional already works in the field or is a hobbyist with vast knowledge in the field. Cases such as Bernard Kalb's, in which professionals jump from one field to another virtually overnight, help reveal what it means to be a professional. Revealing, too, are cases in which non-professionals skip the usual lengthy requirements and become professionals almost instantly. Here we look at two types of such instant professionals. The first, legal but temporary. The second, illegal and often long-term. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds. A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. We're in Chapter 3, continuing with the next subsection, Jurors, Professionals for a Week. Every year, more than 1 million non-professionals get a taste of what it's like to be a professional when they serve on jury duty. Jury work involves decision-making, and so it should be no surprise that the government gives potential jurors a quick, essentials-only version of the special processing described in the previous chapter. As a result, the juror's courtroom adventure bears an uncanny resemblance to professional selection, training, and employment, with the whole process speeded up to such a degree that days represent years. A look at the familiar drill of jury duty reveals what those in charge most want in their decision-makers, and it sets the stage for understanding the conflicts that surround selection for professional school, professional training, after selection, and professional work itself. The first order of business in a trial is probing the attitudes and values of potential jurors through questioning and demographic analysis. Based on the results of this ideological assessment, each candidate is either weeded out or selected to serve on the jury. Favored are people who are programmable but not already programmed. Thus, professionals who are loaded with ideological baggage from their fields and jobs are often excluded. Those selected are then subjected to a whirlwind indoctrination in which the judge impresses upon them that they must accept the law as it is given to them and follow that law rather than their own sense of right and wrong. The judge exhorts jurors not to let their views about the merit of the law affect their work. In the most typical words of the court, the guest professionals are told to judge only the facts of the case, not the law. Jurors who favor decriminalization of marijuana, for example, are expected to vote for conviction anyway if, by their judgment, the defendant really was caught smoking the contraband as charged. Thus, jurors are expected to exercise judgment, but within an assigned ideological framework that they are forbidden to question, just like professionals. For professionals, of course, their employers' ideologies play the role of the law. However, there is an important difference between jurors and real employed professionals. Jurors have greater freedom to criticize the assigned framework of values and to act on their own sense of right and wrong. Unlike professional employees, jurors can follow their consciences without worrying about losing their jobs or losing the favor of people who have power over them. If jurors think the justice demands it, they have the right to violate the court's instructions and judge whether the law itself is just or misapplied. They are not held in contempt of court for doing that. In fact, such nullification of the law by juries has a long and glorious history. Before the Civil War, for example, some northern juries found both slaves and abolitionists not guilty of violating the fugitive slave laws, even though their violation of these laws was clear. Today, the government's approach to the, quote, problem of such independent juries is simply to try to prevent jurors from learning they have a right to criticize the law. As a result, obedient jurors can sometimes be seen after trials apologizing to defendants whom they didn't really want to convict, saying they had no choice. But not all jurors are obedient. That is because the courthouse system of ideological weeding out and indoctrination doesn't work perfectly, mainly because it is so rushed. Thus, even when prosecutors have an airtight case, juries that are uncomfortable with the law or the way the law is being used don't always convict. Sometimes these juries openly criticize the law, but much more often they choose to convince themselves that there is a reasonable doubt in the evidence because they are ignorant of their right to question the law or timid about asserting that right. Each of these types of juror behavior, ranging from outright obedience to principled dissent, with a kind of place-knowing dissent in between, corresponds to an equivalent type of behavior by professionals. Members of the Fully Informed Jury Association, a national organization with headquarters in Montana, are dedicated to educating people about these rights and responsibilities as trial jurors. These activists argue that jurors have a moral responsibility to judge the law and the way the law is being used in the interest of social justice and as a check on those with power. I argue for the same reason all professionals, not just temporary ones, must sit in judgment of the social goals they have been recruited to further. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. We continue with the next section of Chapter 3, Inadvertent Satirists. The values and attitudes that play such an important role in professional work are not quickly or easily learned. More often than not, they are conferred by an upbringing based on middle-class values as opposed to working-class values. Nor are they easily imitated by non-professionals, even those with technical knowledge. Thus, it should be no surprise that employers take these values and attitudes, and not technical knowledge, as the sign of the professional. People with insight, acting ability, and a little knowledge of some profession's technical aspects often take advantage of this fact by using phony credentials or made-up stories about background and training to get and keep professional jobs. For someone hired as a professional in this way, and many are, the job itself serves as a finishing school. Such self-made professionals usually pick fields in which they have worked as non-professionals. By combining the knowledge they gained as non-professionals with a good imitation of the appropriate attitudes and values, they are often extremely successful as professionals. The well-known tendency of employers to overlook the shortcomings of incompetents who display the proper attitude also works to protect these imposters who have technical deficiencies. No one knows exactly how many people without the required credentials are now working in professional positions. Estimates are high, yet few are caught, indicating that most are never uncovered. Newspapers and magazines carry articles on individual cases, but the coverage is uneven, concentrating on the most prestigious professions. Imposter doctors and lawyers are more interesting than imposter accountants and teachers. Judging by these press reports, those crashers who do get caught are typically discovered not because their work arouses suspicion, but because some pattern of eccentric behavior or some breach of professional protocol calls attention to them, or they are caught simply because a sharp-eyed bureaucrat in the personnel office notices a discrepancy during routine record-keeping. Some are on the job for years before it comes out that they lied about their credentials to get hired. Individual examples of imposters are interesting because they are so revealing about what is really required of a professional. What the imposter does to master the essence of a profession and gain acceptance by the employer and, quote, legitimate professionals is so different from what the official story says is required, and yet rings so true that the imitation becomes living satire. In one example, instead of going to high school and college, Daniel Morgan simply hung a Phi Beta Kappa key from his watch chain. Rather than take the bar exam, he sprung for subdued English-cut suits. The black Alabaman, who had studied law in prison, used these props and the name of a legitimate lawyer to operate for 7 years as a high-powered trial lawyer in Chicago. As Edward A. Simmons' counselor at law, Morgan argued hundreds of cases in court and won acquittals for many people, including some facing serious charges such as murder. He built a thriving law practice and established a law firm with fancy offices in the prestigious downtown area, taking on a legitimate lawyer as an associate and renting desk space to young lawyers. With his impressive record of victories in complicated cases in city, state, and federal courts, Morgan was known and respected within his adopted profession. Neither the other lawyers nor the judges had any idea that the high-fee lawyer they were working with was actually a career criminal who had served time in San Quentin, Folsom, Jackson, and Marquette prisons. After he was caught and imprisoned for a few months for contempt of court in Chicago, Morgan reopened for business in Washington, D.C. This time he used the name of a lawyer in another state who was licensed to practice in the Capitol but had never done so. There, as Lawrence A. Harris, Morgan continued his successful law career, becoming one of the best-known criminal lawyers in Washington and boasting a booming clientele. It was his ability to win in the courtroom that led to his exposure. Morgan branched out from criminal law to the big-money field of personal injury, and when he rejected a large out-of-court settlement in an accident case, he was perceived as a threat. Frightened personal injury lawyers investigated and exposed him. Example 2. Bob Harris presented impressive credentials to WCBS Radio in New York, a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Buffalo, a Master of Science degree from New York University, and a PhD from Columbia University. Soon, millions of people were listening to the weather forecasts of Dr. Bob Harris, the meteorologist. Although all three of his degrees were fake, his weather forecast record was good. At the peak of his career, Dr. Bob was forecasting not only for CBS, but also for the New York Times and the Long Island Railroad, taking in a huge total salary. For the New York Times, Harris provided the daily metropolitan, regional, and national forecasts, as well as captions for satellite photographs and national weather maps. For the railroad, he gave advance warnings of big storms. An anonymous letter to the radio station blew his cover. Example 3. Former Army medic Barry Allen Vinoker was so confident he could be a good doctor that he was undeterred by the system's judgment to the contrary. When Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland quickly flunked him out as a pre-med undergraduate, Vinoker borrowed his cousin's excellent pre-med transcripts and got a non-MD surgical research fellowship at Mount Sinai Hospital in Cleveland. At the university, quote, "I couldn't handle the sciences and math," he remembers. "I was spending all my time reading medical journals. I didn't have the discipline for my classes." But at the hospital, the doctors were impressed with the speed with which Vinoker picked up skills on the job. He learned a lot by accompanying doctors in training around the hospital and on rounds, and by watching operations. After spending much of his time as a research fellow in the hospital's adult critical care unit, Vinoker proposed putting together a basic book on critical care medicine. Thus, Vinoker and three doctors edited the Handbook of Critical Care, which was printed in many languages and is still used in the field. While at Mount Sinai, Vinoker also authored and co-authored many research papers and medical conference presentations on intensive care medicine. Vinoker's career at Mount Sinai came to an end not because doctors discovered that he was a college dropout. They didn't find out about that, but because doctors were offended when they found out that Vinoker had put the letters M.D. after his name in a letter to a publisher that he was trying to interest in a monograph. Determined not to have his medical experience and future work taken less seriously because of his lack of formal schooling, Vinoker drew again on his cousin's records, this time his medical school transcripts, and declared himself a doctor. He got a position as a resident, first at San Francisco's Mount Zion Hospital, and then after only a year at the prestigious University of California Medical Center in San Francisco. He thereby gave some of the state's most well-papered physicians a medical school reject as a colleague. Vinoker worked in one of the most demanding of medical specialties, neonatology, where he won great respect for his skills and techniques in caring for extremely ill premature infants in the medical intensive care nursery. Vinokur was considered unusually dedicated to his work. He personally headed an air ambulance service to bring in critically ill infants. He did research and participated in press conferences featuring work in which he was involved. He gained national attention for his part in a discovery related to the diagnosis and treatment of hyperammoanemia, a rare but life-threatening ailment of newborns. After 3 years at the University of California Medical Center, Vinokur was encouraged to apply for a position on the faculty. Routine processing of his application turned up his cousin's records, which, except for the nickname Barry, were virtually identical to his. The masquerade ended with an embarrassed University of California and a deal in which Vinokur pleaded no contest to two misdemeanors. He was fined $200, put on 18 months probation, and ordered to provide 100 hours of community service. Thousands of American doctors are working on the basis of phony resumes or false credentials. This fact came out in 1984 during the various state and federal investigations that began with the arrest of Pedro de Meisones, who sold about 100 Caribbean medical school degrees to Americans for $5,000 to $50,000 each. The general re-examination of credentials that this case touched off revealed many imposters, but in the process it revealed something that investigators would just as soon have kept quiet. Most of the imposters would never have been exposed by their work as doctors, even though they typically worked in situations where medical professionals observed their work daily. One imposter found working in a hospital was described by the hospital administrator as the brightest resident we have. Similar praise went to Raymond Allard and Barbara Gillen, who worked as interns at Worcester City Hospital in Massachusetts until the 17th of April in 1984. The day hospital administrators learned that the two, quote, doctors were actually a physician's assistant and a nurse, who'd bought medical school degrees from De Meisones. Ray and Barbara are very bright, capable doctors, Dr. James L. McGuire, head of medical education at the hospital, told the New York Times. According to the Times, doctors on the hospital staff were unanimous in their praise for the performance, capability, and motivation of the two, said Dr. Jack Kelly, a staff physician. If I had doubts about the backgrounds of any of the interns, they would be the ones I would be least suspicious of. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt. Continuing on with the next subsection of Chapter 3, titled Real World, quote-unquote, Credentials. Unlike these imposters, real professionals go through a crucial part of their training away from the workplace. Seclusion at the university allows time to study the field's technical details, while the social isolation there facilitates indoctrination into the field's culture, the culture that imposters know so well. In spite of the fact that the university plays this important role in society, students often talk of it as not being part of the real world. It is certainly easy to see things that way. The university world, symbolized by the physically isolated, self-contained park-like campus, with services careful to meet middle-class standards, proclaims itself a community of scholars and students free from the directions and minute-to-minute discipline imposed on persons working elsewhere. The real world, on the other hand, is symbolized by cities like Detroit and New York, centers of production and the control of production, where the hierarchy of power and wealth is clear, and no one is surprised to encounter exploitation, alienation, and crime. In this real world, employers call the shots. Individuals are hired and fired on the basis of cold judgment of their worth. With a great deal at stake and competitors playing for keeps, employers must renew their no-nonsense attitude every day. Those who hold this two-worlds point of view usually don't think of the realm of the academics as serving the realm of the employers. Indeed, many feel that the university is dysfunctional for the system, that the university makes it easy for students to drift into deviant patterns of thought and to demand change. Yet the simple fact is that the students the university trains and certifies as professionals do go out and function for the system and uphold the status quo. For example, at least 90% of Harvard Law School graduates join corporate law firms. As Calvin Trillin noted in an article in The New Yorker about the ongoing struggle between leftist and conservative professors at that school, why, it might be argued, should anyone think it is anything but inevitable that the preeminent law schools of a capitalist society produce lawyers to serve the society's preeminent capitalists? I suppose it's possible to see Harvard Law School as an institution willing to harbor left-wing professors who are trying to subvert the young, but another way to look at it is an institution that each fall takes 500 of our brightest, most idealistic young people and in 3 years transforms them into Wall Street money grubbers. Close quote. If the Ivory Tower in its work as a training institution does indeed serve the system by orienting professionals in training to their role in the real world, then how does it do this? My thesis here is that the mechanism involves the qualifying examination and other requirements for professional credentials that certifying institutions enforce. The requirements for professional standing in a field reflect the social function of professionals in that field, their role in the real world, not just some eternal standards of excellence or of proficiency in the tricks of the trade. To explain in detail the mechanism by which the university produces professionals who will play the desired role, and to explain the nature of that role, I use the production of physicists as a primary example. The mechanism of selection in physics is the PhD qualifying examination system, which has much in common with systems that other fields use to select professionals. The qualifying examination system is the procedure by which physics graduate students, usually at the beginning of their third year, are told whether or not they will be permitted to continue and complete the work necessary to receive the PhD degree. This examination system gives physics graduate students at most universities an ugly and unforgettable reminder of the real world each and every year as some fellow graduate students are expelled from the university. I will put off discussing the details of these expulsions because it is impossible to comprehend fully the mechanism by which people are selected to play a particular role in society without first understanding the role they are being selected to play. For example, of physics, one needs to know something about the nature of the work assignments that physicists are prepared to take. Put more generally, a real understanding of the existence and nature of the politics of expert qualification grows out of an understanding of what the expert actually does in society. The typical misunderstanding of the politics of expert qualification, usually a denial of any politics, grows out of an idealized view of what the expert does, a view that fails to reflect the social role of the expert's field. What an expert actually does in society is most accurately determined by asking, what is the social function of the expert's field of work? Many people can tell you the qualifying political mentality for an occupation where that mentality is blatantly obvious, as in the case of, say, police. People can even go on to tell you how that mentality reflects the social order that the occupation helps to maintain. Yet many of these same people accept without question the popular notion that, in general, the qualifications required to do professional work are not ideological. A look at physicists counters this mystification of professional work. Specifically, an examination of the social role of the physicist's work helps reveal the politics of professional qualification in physics. The key to understanding the social role of physicists and of all professionals is appreciating the extent to which individuals in the field determine their own work and the extent to which their work is externally directed. The question is, who's in charge? The answer tells us which sector of society the physicist serves. In the following chapter, I address this question of control by looking first at industrial and governmental physicists, and then at the more difficult case of university physicists. The discussion takes advantage of the fact that university physics departments as a group are highly homogeneous in their essential features. The physics department at the University of California, Irvine, where I was trained, has more than 100 professors, research physicists, and graduate students, and is a typical department in terms of research and training. A look at the nature of that research in that department and the handling of graduate students there will tell us a lot about university research and training in physics in the United States.